Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, we've got food stamps turning 50, Michael Lewis on how the stock market's rigged, and some disconcerting new data on housing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Los Angeles, I'm David Gura. It's Tuesday, April 1st. There's a lot about the markets in the news today. Goldman Sachs is reportedly leaving the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. That's maybe a sign that trading nowadays doesn't really take place in a room full of humans so much as in rooms that are full of computers. And the FBI today announced it's been investigating high-frequency traders over the last year or so to see whether insider trading is happening at large firms. All of that is the subject of Michael Lewis's new book. It's called Flash Boys, and it's a look at the new reality of trading stocks. A trade now takes just a fraction of a second. Earlier today, Michael Lewis sat down with Kai Rizdahl.
This is a book fundamentally about how what we think happens on Wall Street isn't really what's happening on Wall Street. So that was my first question to Michael Lewis. We all have this image of a market, which is a guy standing on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange or someplace in a funny color jacket, probably screaming out orders. And the gist of this book basically is that that vision is just wrong. And if you see the market that way, you're not actually seeing the market.
The New York Stock Exchange is now just a backdrop for TV shows. I mean, it's not the stock market. We don't have an accurate mental picture of it, and that's true. And the reason for that is it's all been automated in the last decade. So it's all the meaningful stuff happens inside of black boxes, and it happens at computer time rather than human time. And I think this is the hardest thing people have getting their minds around, is that to a computer, a second is a long time. Thousands of trades can be made in a second.
People think pushing a button is still pushing a button to execute a trade, and really it's just not.
Well, it's much more complicated. What happens when you push a button? I mean, really the story I tell is really about one Wall Street trader around 2008 figuring out that when he pushed the button to buy some stock, that the market was no longer the market he was familiar with, that the market actually seemed to anticipate what he was doing and get ahead of him. And so the story is really his investigation of what happens when you push that button.
This guy, his name is Brad Katsuyama. He worked at the time at Royal Bank of Canada. What did he discover? What was his insight?
Well, the first thing that happens to him is he's trying to buy whatever is on his computer screens. The screens say that in the 13 public stock markets in the United States, there are, say, 10,000 shares of Microsoft offered at $20 a share. And up to this moment, up to about 2008, when he pushed the button to buy those, he got them all. Now, all of a sudden, he pushes the button and he gets a few of them, but the rest go away and the price goes up as if someone's front-running him. That when he pushed the button, he was actually sitting in Lower Manhattan. That's where his desk was. And the signal to buy traveled up the West Side Highway of Manhattan and through the Lincoln Tunnel. And the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, there is one of the 13 exchanges called the BATS Exchange. And on the BATS Exchange, high-frequency traders were waiting to sell a little bit of Microsoft to find someone who might want to buy it. And the minute they found that they had this big buyer coming through BATS, they raced him to all the other exchanges because they had faster paths through New Jersey to those other exchanges, bought up all the Microsoft, and sold it back to him at a higher price. That's what he finds out happened.
This guy you found, Brad Katsuyama, he says, and the clear import of your story is that the markets are fundamentally rigged. They're fixed. Explain that for me.
Yeah, no, this, you know, using that word rigged gets people very upset, mm-hmm. but he does say it, and I agree with it, and it's rigged in this sense, and I'll do it. Let me give you an analogy that I think is pretty close. Imagine a casino wants to create a new poker game, and it wants to get people into the poker game, and it goes to a handful of good poker players, and it says, hey, if you sit at this table, you can deal the cards, and you alone will know that the decks have no fours, no nines, and no queens in it. Then they go to, like, tour bus companies, and they say, bring in tourists to come play against these guys. We're not going to tell those people that there are no queens or nines or fours in the deck. And, of course, the guys who know the missing cards have this huge tactical advantage over the suckers who roll into the casino. And basically, in this analogy, the casinos are the stock exchanges. They provide this unfair edge to the high-frequency traders who are the card sharks. And investors are the guys on the tour bus who are rolled in to play against the high-frequency traders.
I get that if I'm the chief investment officer for some big retirement fund or a large institutional investor, I get that I'm on the losing end of this because I'm trading in huge volume. But if I'm sitting at home buying 100 shares of Microsoft for my kid's college account, do I lose in this deal?
Probably not. If it's just 100 shares, but you lose this deal in other ways. So this is the problem. Most people who have savings in the stock market, most of those dollars are actually run by pension funds and mutual funds. So the savings of ordinary people are taxed in that way. But the bigger problem is that in order to sort of structure the stock market to maximize the number of collisions between high-frequency traders and ordinary investors, the structure that has evolved has gotten very, very complicated and, in the minds of a lot of people on Wall Street, unstable. And the truth is very few people are just trading 100 shares. Most people's savings are wrapped up in bigger funds.
The latest from Michael Lewis is called Flash Boys. It's a good one. Michael, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kai Ryssdal talking to Michael Lewis, the author of Flash Boys. Some joy on Wall Street today. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. Got some new housing data today that's actually pretty meh. Construction spending rose a measly 0.1% in February. Now, that's partly because of the wild weather we had this winter, but economists say that only accounts for part of the sluggishness. It seems we're not building or buying homes like we used to. Pending home sales have fallen to the lowest level in years. And so far, 2014 isn't looking so hot for housing. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith says it's all about the three L's.
You can lay part of the blame for the listless housing market on the late spring. It's hard to start building or even looking to buy a house when it's less than 0 degrees out.
It's not just weather conditions. This may be as good as it gets for a while, actually.
Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate and finance at Wharton. She says the health of housing comes down to three L's. For starters, labor and loans.
Jobs and affordability of mortgages are the two fundamental drivers of the housing market. And they're both weak right now.
The lackluster labor market means people don't want to make big investments, like buying a house. And even then, landing a loan isn't easy, says Nicholas Ritsinas with the Harvard Business School.
The bread and butter of the housing market is first-time home buyers. They continue to have increasing difficulty getting a mortgage, accessing credit.
And those loans have to be a little larger because of the third L, lumber, says Patrick Newport, an economist with IHS.
Costs have been going up. Cost of lumber has been going up.
Demand from China and other elements have lifted lumber prices, making building less lucrative for builders and a lot costlier for buyers. That's lousy news for the economy, says Newport.
Basically, the housing market's been moving sideways over the past 6 months. And that's very disappointing because housing is supposed to be one of the key linchpins that will get the economy back on track.
A lively housing market creates a larger demand for lucrative construction jobs, says Newport. But until we see more life in the housing market, that sector of the economy is out of luck. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I'm going to guess this probably isn't on your calendars, but the Monaco Yacht Show is coming up in a few months. And for the uninitiated, that's the world's largest showcase for super and mega yachts. Well, I cruised over to its website, if you'll pardon the pun, and it says the yacht industry is beginning to bounce back from the recession. But did it ever really take a hit? Sally Herships reports.
Turns out the yacht industry is not that different from the housing industry. Take interior design.
It's virtually the same thing, except it costs a lot more money. You know, sometimes it could be $1 million and sometimes it could be $5 million.
Claudette Bonville is an interior designer for yachts. She says when it comes to large luxury yachts.
8 years ago, we would be doing a lot more new builds. Now, there's not that many new builds being done, of that particular size in the United States.
Bonvell says since the stormy seas of the recession, it became popular to buy used and redo interiors. It is the yacht as economic indicator.
The yacht industry is the first thing to crash and the last thing to come back.
Lang Ryder runs the marine lending division for Seacoast National Bank. He says there was even a boating bubble. Owners needed cash, so they sold and prices dropped.
Well, the bubble was, you know, overnight, if you had a boat in 2007 that was worth $1.5 million, in 2009 it might be worth $750,000.
Ryder says his bank's business of loans for yachts is still off by 45% from pre-recession. Since the economy is still weak, he says wealthy buyers are paying in cash, not tying up their money in low-return investments. Philip Winter is president of Naos Yachts, a dealer. He says if you're looking at the yacht as an economic indicator, be sure to ignore the super rich.
They could have bought 5 years ago, 3 years ago, or today. Not much change in that situation.
I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sales of single-serve coffee are way up, and I'm talking here about what are known as K-cups or coffee pods. You put them in a machine, and in no time at all, you've got one single cup of coffee. Well, Roberto Ferdman writes for Quartz, and he's looked into the coffee pod industry, and he says its growth may not be such a good thing. It's great to talk to you, Roberto.
It's good to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
So, not 10 feet from where I'm sitting, we've got one of these old-fashioned drip coffee makers. I can almost smell that coffee cooking in the carafe. And I gather that we are behind the times, that most people in most workplaces would have a one-cup coffee maker.
I'm not sure if I would go that far. Okay. Drip coffee machines still outsell pod machines in the U.S. They don't in Western Europe. But K-cups are so popular now that they account for something like 25% of ground coffee sales in the U.S.,
When I make coffee with a drip coffee maker, afterward I throw out that filter and the grounds therein. With a pod, you're throwing away a lot of plastic.
That's right. So about 5% of K-cups are currently recyclable. It's something that Keurig or Green Mountain really wants to fix. By 2020, they claim they'll fix the problem entirely. But at the moment, 95% of the K-cups that are being used, and there are many K-cups being used, are not even recyclable.
How many of these do we go through in a year?
So in 2011, there were enough K-cups used to encircle the globe more than six times. If you were to extrapolate that to the numbers last year, in 2013, it would be more than 10 times, something like 10.5 times.
So just in general, how have these coffee pods, these K-cups, affected the coffee market?
Americans don't drink as much coffee, historically speaking, as they like to think they do. Peak coffee consumption on a liquid basis anyway was back in the 1940s.
Is that right?
That is
that
right.
That does surprise
me. It has been pretty systematically falling ever since the 1940s. And since coffee pods help regulate the amount of coffee one drinks when having a cup of coffee, it means that they don't overserve themselves. So it's possible that the rise of coffee pods will actually mean the fall of per capita coffee consumption.
Roberto Ferdman's a staff reporter for Quartz, who's written about the world's growing love affair with the most wasteful form of coffee there is. Thanks, Roberto.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Coming up.
This little dude right here needs breakfast in the morning, and so you just come at night and get it over with.
Who relies on food stamps? Poor people, yes, but also a bunch of Fortune 500 companies. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 74 points, 0.4%, and at 16,532. The Nasdaq jumped 69 points, 1.6%, closing at 4268. And the S&P 500 rose 13 points, 0.7%, finishing at 1885. That's a record. Casino companies that bet on Macau cashed in after the territory reported a jump in gambling revenue. MGM Resorts was up 2.5%. Las Vegas Sands rose 2.4%. And Wynn Resorts added 2.25%. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for February. The House Small Business Committee holds a hearing on Bitcoin, examining the benefits and risks for small business. And sandwiched between all the big news is National Peanut Butter and Jelly Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura. Food stamps turned 50 this year, and use of the program has soared, especially recently. One in seven Americans uses food stamps today. That's more than twice the rate in the year 2000. Last year, the food stamp program infused the economy with $76 billion. Well, over the next few days, our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark is going to look at what this growth in food stamps can tell us about the American economy today. She starts things off by shining some light on some of the biggest financial winners of the food stamp program, ones that mostly fly under the radar, not low-income families, but the Fortune 500 companies where they shop.
As the clock struck midnight last night, some lines of computer code got triggered. And in that instant, hundreds of millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, got zapped into little plastic debit cards tucked into wallets and purses across the country. Depending on where you live, this will happen at different midnights throughout the month until 47 million Americans receive their monthly food stamp benefits, on average about $130 a person. And within minutes of getting that money, people will start spending it.
This little dude right here needs breakfast in the morning, and so you just come at night and get it over with.
I met Yolanda Ballard and her 8-year-old son recently outside a Walmart supercenter in Dayton, Ohio. It was 12:15 a.m. and snowing, and they were pushing a shopping cart toward their car.
I spent almost $98.
$98?
Yeah.
Ballard is a widow in her 40s with a part-time job at the discount store Dollar General. She'd love to work full-time, but so far no luck. Ballard's food stamp card had just been recharged, a big relief since her benefits usually run out by the third week of the month.
And then you're kind of really low on groceries, so then you're kind of putting stuff together and trying to make it happen until your stamps come.
Now, in the news, in politics, a lot of focus gets put on the Yolanda Ballards of America. Who gets food stamps, whether they deserve them, what kind of food they spend them on. But what gets relatively little attention is where that money goes after the food gets scanned, rung up.
Total comes to $190.68.
And paid for.
Here's your receipt. Thank you. You have a nice day.
Because that money doesn't just disappear. It becomes revenue, lots of revenue, for businesses. Last year, a record $76 billion flowed from the U.S. Treasury into people's food stamp cards and on into the cash registers of more than 240,000 stores, each one approved by the federal government to participate in the food stamp program. You can think of food stamps as a government subsidy with two lives. First, a subsidy for poor people to buy food, and then a stimulus for corporations that sell that food at a profit. So let's pay some attention right now to how this second food stamp subsidy really works.
At our store, at least, it's always the same.
On those nights when food stamp cards get recharged and customers rush into stores to buy stuff, Anthony Pettiford has been on the other side of that transaction. He used to work at a Kroger supermarket in Fairborn, Ohio, and he says you could hear the food stamp dollars coming.
You have carts that are just full, and it's funny because the noise that a cart makes when it's stacked and it's heavy is this loud squeaking noise, and that's all you hear in the stores. it's just mind-numbing.
Bread, meats, milk, cheese.
Store inventory follows the rhythm of food stamp dollars. Mary Burkett, an assistant manager at a Walmart supercenter in Huber Heights, Ohio, told me on the days food stamp cards get recharged, her store stocks up on certain things.
All the staples that you'd have at your house is usually what disappears the fastest. So you want to make sure you talk to your vendors. If you don't have your staples and everything, you know, customers are going to be upset. You'll lose sales.
Just how much in sales does any particular company get through the food stamp program? Well, that's where things get tricky. We don't actually know because the information is secret. For one, stores don't want to share that information.
We don't provide our market share data on any categories or anything like that.
David Tovar is a company spokesman for Walmart, which takes in a lot of food stamp dollars, though they don't like to say how many.
It's generally proprietary in nature.
And if you put yourself in Tovar's shoes, you can see why Walmart or any other store would want to keep this stuff confidential. Even basic things like how many food stamp dollars go to a particular store in a particular location, that's valuable market information.
I think any information that a retailer shares about how they're serving customers and how they're going to market would be interesting to lots of other retailers.
But say you're not a retailer. Say you're just someone who wants to know how this government program meant to fight hunger really works and who it works for. You might wonder which stores profit the most from food stamps, what kinds of foods they promote and sell, what their business practices are. And typically, if a business participates in a government program, you can find out how much they're getting paid. But in the case of food stamps?
Up to this point in time, we have not been able to release such data.
Kevin Concannon is the Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. His agency has long claimed it is forbidden by law from sharing data about food stamp sales, that there's a provision that protects certain retailer information from being shared. Recently, a federal appeals court ruled the USDA has been misinterpreting that law and sent the issue to be reviewed by a lower court. And in fact, even Kevin Concannon from the USDA thinks this food stamp sales information would be good to share.
I think personally it's in the interest of the American public. These are public benefits that are moving through the economy.
But when I asked Concannon about his agency's efforts in court to keep this data private and whether he would press them to give that fight up.
Well, the first thing I'd have to do is talk to the lawyers before I declare on Marketplace what they should do.
Which is all to say that for now, at least, we still don't know just how much money stores make from the food stamp program. But we do know that money really matters.
Hi, this is Carol Schumacher, Vice President of Investor Relations for Walmart Stores, Inc.
Walmart shareholders have been learning the bottom line value of food stamps recently, starting when the company explained disappointing profits and fourth quarter store sales in a recorded earnings call earlier this year. Congress had just reduced food stamp benefits, officially called SNAP, for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, by about $30 a family. Some of Walmart's top executives, Bill Simon, Rosalind Brewer, and Charles Hawley, all blamed their company's sales slump on bad weather and
SNAP benefit reductions.
The reduction in SNAP benefits.
The reduction in SNAP that really hit us in the fourth quarter.
And it's not just Walmart, though it likely receives the most food stamp dollars. Walmart did confirm for me that it takes in an estimated 18% of all food stamp spending. That's a share worth about $13 billion. But food stamps have become baked into the business models of lots of big-name stores since the Great Recession. The number of stores authorized to accept food stamps has more than doubled since the year 2000. A few years ago, the CEO of Family Dollar told shareholders that expanding into the now multi-billion dollar food stamp market represented a, quote, significant opportunity that would help their stores weather the bad economy. The more people struggle to get by, the more valuable food stamps become for business.
We look forward to being your partner in this very important enterprise.
The value of food stamp dollars for retailers is something the USDA uses as a selling point, like in this food stamp training video that they send to stores that apply to be in the food stamp program.
Thank you for participating.
It's a symbiotic relationship. The government needs stores to make SNAP or food stamps work and serve low-income people. So why not remind stores what's in it for them?
Accepting SNAP benefits can be a profitable part of your operation.
Profitable for companies and potentially for their workers, too. Kevin Concannon with the USDA told me a story about a visit he made to a supermarket chain in Texas called HEB.
And I was standing in a store in the San Antonio area with the vice president of the company.
The company vice president started pointing at clerks behind the counter.
And he said, "See these folks here? We are able to employ more of those or to employ them with more hours per month due directly to the financial impact of food stamp benefits."
But there's something else important to point out about the jobs people get at stores that profit from food stamps. In many cases, at many different stores, those jobs pay so little The store's own workers depend on food stamps, too. More on that tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The digital version of this story is produced in collaboration with Slate. You can check it out on marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
We were talking about housing earlier. This final note is about a 13-room house that's being built in the Netherlands with a 3D printer. President Obama checked out models of the house last week. So far, one corner is up just off a canal in Amsterdam. The builders say this is the future of construction. There's no waste. And as a bonus, if you get tired of your house, well, you can chuck the whole thing in the recycling bin, one big recycling bin. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 74 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ jumped 69 points, 1.6%. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, 0.7%. Nancy Fargali is the special projects producer. John Ketchum is the producer on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm David Gura, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.